Tango Tango Papa 1999, September 23rd, 2017.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from Columbus, Ohio. So it has been not quite a month since I recorded the last podcast. So I have made a trip home and was home for, took my 5 days off, and now I am back at work. I've been back at work for about, today was the fourth day back at work, so everything's kind of going along like it normally does. Once I came back to work, I made a trip to the Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania area, and then I went from Pittsburgh, I went out to Palmyra, Pennsylvania, that's near Hershey. And then now I'm on my way to Edwardsville, Illinois, which is the St. Louis area. They had told me that they had this load that I was going to pick up at Palmyra that delivered to and deliver to Utah, but then I guess that load canceled. And so then, you know, and they came up with the Palmyra to Edwardsville, which is just fine because they keep me busy anyway, so it doesn't really matter. If you watch the news, or you know, kind of do what I do, and I just hopefully I'm going to lay back right here. Hopefully we won't get blasted with too much air noise. If you do what I do, I just kind of glance through headlines, and I do read the occasional story if I find the headline interesting enough, but generally speaking, I am not emotionally involved with the news. And, you know, I try, you know, I don't know how well I accomplish it, but I tend not to be really too emotionally involved with anything. And you know, emotional involvement is, you know, sort of the vehicle that we use as human beings to play God. You know, that's one of the things that we do. I believe that a real human being, an evolved human being, does not use emotions. It just leaves those emotions alone. People will violently disagree with me, you know, and usually those are the people that are really into their emotions, and they think their emotions are somehow the key to their success, or to the key. They'll tell you that it's you know, it's what makes us a human. No, it doesn't. Your emotions turn you into an animal. Your dog gets emotional, or name any, you know, even you know, insects get emotional, you know, all kinds of different animals become emotional. Human beings are a creature that has the ability to rise above that. But the key is, you have to want to rise above it, as opposed to being enslaved to it. So, but in any case, there's all kinds of just crazy news headlines and crazy things going on. And then, of course, people have become more emotional than ever, because again, they think that their emotions, there's this delusion, and it is a delusion, that if they just get emotional, you know, just get more emotional, and somehow that's going to make things better. Their problem is, you know, it's kind of like the cannibal going to a cannibal psychiatrist, and the cannibal psychiatrist says, you know what your problem is? You're just not eating enough. You need to eat more people. You know, that's the source of your anxiety, is that you're not eating enough people. You need to eat more people. So if you go to a lot of the pop psychologists thing, you know, the general feeling is that, you're not emotional enough. You're not sensitive. You need to be more sensitive. You have to be more sensitive. And that's exactly the opposite. It's the wrong, it's the wrong advice leading you in the wrong direction. So, the answer is to not be emotional. So, and to just, and it's easy for me to say not be emotional, because if you're trapped in your emotions, you are a slave of them, and you can't have any control over that. All you can do is maybe, dive deeper into the emotions. Or, switch at one emotional attachment for something else. I mention it once in a while. If you go to my website, truckertompodcast.com, up at the top there's a link that says meditation. Click on that link. There's about four MP3 files that you can either listen to on the website or download them to your phone or whatever, the MP3 playback of your device of your choice. Put them on, burn them onto a CD, whatever. The gist of it is that those files will teach you how to, it's just very simple meditation technique. And it's not, usually people, it's been my experience, people can get instant relief if they practice that meditation. But it's up to you to continue. If you find that it helps you, it's up to you to continue with it. You can't just listen to it. You've got to, perform the little simple practice. And it's got to be done on a regular schedule. At least, when you start, two or three times a day is good. And over a long period of time, the whole point of the meditation is to, we as human beings have this little point, among other things, we have this point of awareness where we can be aware somehow of one thing at a time. People like to think, I'm multitasking or what. No, you're not. You're really only aware of one thing at a time, if you're honest with yourself. You can try to slice that up and, be a little aware of this and aware of that and kind of jump back and forth, but you can only really be aware of one thing at a time. But we have this point of awareness. So the point is, your thoughts are you. A lot of times people think, well, my thoughts, that's me. That's my identity. No, it isn't. We as human beings have this point of awareness, and if you learn to practice this meditation, it will prove to you beyond any shadow of a doubt that you, the point of awareness, is you are separate from the thoughts that are in your head, that fill your head. And you can actually hold your awareness separate from those thoughts. And you learn to be in the present moment, and that is where your creator is at. It's not in the past and it's not in the future. All there really is the present moment. So, at some point, I don't know, a few years ago, I kind of ended up being, you know, kind of not having, you know, and I couldn't really express it at the time, but I knew that I was kind of in the world and I could interact with the world, but I wasn't of it anymore. And put that another way, it's as if God sort of took the emotions away. He sort of saved me from the emotions. And so I look out and I see the problems with the world, and I know that, you know, there's certain dangers with the world, but at the same time I'm able to interact with it, and but I'm not really threatened by it. My identity isn't threatened by it. The relationship that I have with my Creator isn't threatened by it. You know, so I'll put it this way. Do you want to live, is it fun living your life kind of on the edge with all these crazy, you know, the crazy human beings around you just acting like idiots? You know, and threatening war and doing this and doing that. Is that fun? Do you like that? Or the drug addicts or all the crazy people in the news that are, you know, that have all these stupid things that they're doing. Do you like that? You know, do you like, do you have a drug addict relative or a crazy relative that's, you know, going through all kinds of drama and you're sort of caught in the middle? Do you like that? You know, heaven forbid it's your spouse or somebody directly in your family that's doing something like that. Or would you rather be able to just, you know, kind of see that, but be sort of distant, you know, and at the same time have a distance from it? And so I know that I'm in this world. I've got this physical body. My point of awareness is kind of in this world, in this physical body. But at the same time, it's like, you know, and it's really difficult to describe, but it's almost as if I'm in an alternate, you know, I'm in a different universe, sort of looking out at all this craziness. But somehow I am not threatened by it. And the, you know, it's really difficult to say, but, or to express, I am absolutely at peace. Regardless of what's going on, you know, somebody could be threatening, hey, we're going to press this button, you know, Kim Jong-un or whatever his name is could press, say, I'm pressing this button and you're, you know, and one of your cities is just going to, we're going to nuke, you know, some city in the U.S. That could be happening, and I'm still 100% perfectly at peace. Now, how can that be? It's a paradox. So I can't promise that meditation will help everybody, but I do believe it will help the vast majority of people if they will give it a try. Now, some people won't, you know, I don't know. It seems to me there's a lot of people that are maybe scared of trying it. I don't know. It's a strange thing that they're sort of afraid of trying it, or they'll say, oh, that doesn't work for me or whatever. Well, did you really try it? No, I didn't. Well, then quit complaining. So, anyhow, I've got a couple of voice files I got one from Joel that I'm going to play first, and I've had that one the longest. And then I think the one that I'm going to play from Jeremy was probably from about a week or so ago. So we're going to start out with Joel. So here is Joel.
Hey, Tom. It's Joel here. listening to, still partway through your show, your last show that came out, listening to you talk about Harvey and the official rescuers or whatever it is. And I'm like, thinking about that, how many people wait for things to be done for them versus jumping in and just helping? You know, that goes back to pretty much everything in society as of late now. You've got people waiting for aid, you know, waiting for this, waiting for that. And they never get it. That's like, I listened to the Michael Knowles show, which is one of the ones over on the Daily Wire, the Ben Shapiro and all that. And there was a girl on there, millennial, on that show that said being poor made her Republican because of just having to depend on the government for things really made her see the waste in it. I don't know her entire story, but it had something to do with where, like she was in high school or something, and her, Alexa, stop. Sorry about that. She had to wait for things or something to that effect, which goes back kind of to my deal where of all the things that I've needed over my life, either things from the things that I did myself, were the only things that were on time. Things that I did. Not waiting on, you know, if I sat and waited for people to do things for me, then they'd never be done. If I did it myself, things got done. So, anytime I've ever let government, waited for government to do something for me, they failed me. For example, if I waited for government to decide when to seek shelter from a storm, I'd be dead by now. You know? So, just something to think about, something that, you know, I wish more people thought my way.
Okay, well, thank you, Joel. It's a kind of a strange thing that happens in people's minds. And I think what it really goes back to, you know, this idea that we're going to have the government do this and the government do that. The government, it really comes down to this. You know, do you believe in God or not? You know, and then people will say, oh, yes, I believe in God. But do they really? Because if you really believe, if you know, in fact, that there is a God, it goes beyond, you know, believing that there is or believing in the possibility. But if you know that there is a God on a very deep level, you know there's a God, then you're not going to kind of wait around for, you know, some external, you know, entity, you know, and it's almost a, you know, the government's sort of like a make-believe entity because it's, you know, it does what, you know, can, you know, we know where the buildings are and we have these people that call themselves public officials that represent it. But it's really, it doesn't exist. It's just something that human beings have tried to create. You know, they talk about having, you know, atheists will make ridicule religion or people that believe in God, you know, and they say, oh, you're going to, you have some kind of sky daddy, sky sugar daddy or whatever that's going to save you. Okay, well, the same thing can be said about the government. But so it comes down to really, do you, if you know there's a God, how does that God, how do you come into contact with it? Well, for one way, you know, the only real way is to, you know, you can come into contact with God through God's creations. You know, namely, probably the most, you know, in the realm of human beings, it would be you come into contact with other human beings. You interact with other human beings. And, you know, if you doubt that there's a God, or if you're, you know, you claim you're an atheist and you're completely separated and you just can't believe that there's a God, and, you know, we just kind of, everything's just sort of this unbelievable accident where everything just turned out just so-so. And that's why we're all here and we're all aware and everything, you know, the universe is just, everything is just so-so, and, you know, to the point where we're able to have the existence that we do. And not only do we have the existence that we do, but we're aware of it. And it's just all some weird accident that just some kind of randomly happened somehow. And so if you believe that, then of course you're going to be trying to, you know, you have a religion. And your religion is, you know, it's a religion of secular fundamentalism. You believe that... you know, government is God, and you're going to create your own, God out of it. And, you know, it's a bizarre thing that happens, but, it really comes down to, I think, you know, you can kind of use it as a barometer. How separated are people from their creator? Because I would contend that the more separated people are from their actual conscience, because that's how God interfaces with us, is through, you know, we know, you know, it's a guilty conscience. God's communicating with us, and that's a guilty conscience. Society programmed that into me. That I got to run away from that. You know, see that as a guilty conscience, and then, you know, and then we'll get official recognition from the government. Oh, if you'll just, you know, we can get official recognition, and then it's going to make it okay that we kill our babies, you know, unwanted byproduct of sexes. That's all going to be okay. You know, rape and robbery and murder. Oh, that's all okay. It's socialism. Robbery is okay. Robbing from my neighbors. Oh, that's okay. It's called socialism, for example. And of course, they try to twist that around and turn it into some sort of a virtue. So... but it's a really weird thing that people do, and, you know, and you wonder, you know, the Bible says that our ideas of right and wrong are like smelly rags to God, you know, and smelly rags basically is referring to female tampons. Our sense of right and wrong as human beings is like smelly tampons to God. And it's because our sense of right and wrong are based on what? They're typically based on emotions. And emotions, generally speaking, are backwards. we abuse those emotions in order to, you know, make ourselves feel better, try to make ourselves feel better. You know, government's going to officially recognize, you know, all of the things that I do wrong. It's going to officially recognize that and kind of help separate me from conscience. So, anyway, I could go on and on, but I think I've probably made the point. Anyway, also have a comment from Joel. Now, this one's a longer comment, so I haven't listened to any of it yet, so we're going to be listening to it together for the first time, so I may end up doing a stop-start on it. But in any case, here is Jeremy, not Joel, Jeremy.
Hey Tom, it's Jeremy here. Hopefully this is working. I'm using my car's Bluetooth to record something to you. So I'm commuting on my way home from work. So this is always a good time to check in and see how things are going. I know it's been a while. It's been actually a busy time switching to a different vehicle and shopping around and stuff like that. I did settle on a smaller car, kind of like you did with yours, your new one. I went with a Kia, but it's a hatchback. So again, that same form factor. I just like the idea of a smaller car for the commute. It's putting a lot of miles on my sedan, and it was just time to pack it in. That thing had 175,000 miles on it, and it got me a lot of places last summer, but on my way back from Florida on our road trip, started seeing the dashboard light up like a Christmas tree. And so that's when I started shopping around. I'm a CarMax guy, so I don't like to do the whole bargaining and traditional dealership thing. So I typically just do all my shopping online, narrow down my choices, and I narrowed it down to a couple of cars that I had shipped in and transferred over to my local store here, and settled on this one. So is it the best quality car now? It's a little 2.0 four banger, and it's not going to beat anybody in a drag race for sure. But and it does require that I modify my driving a little bit because I did have a heavy foot with my old V6. It was easy to get around anybody who might have been in your way. And now I kind of have to be a little bit more moderate, which is good. I'm not a kid anymore. I got to grow up a little bit anyway. So it'll be fine. So I have a 2015 Forte 5 used car with about 40 grand on it. And that's pretty much just what I need right now. I'm planning on my next car will be a Tesla. That's what I'm always going to say. My next car is going to be a Tesla. And I'll just keep saying that. Because it doesn't look like it's going to be affordable anytime soon. So anyway, it's got some of the creature comforts I like. You know, it's got heated seats for the winter. The driver's seat has built-in AC for the summer. You know, got the Bluetooth, which I didn't used to have in my old 2007. But I did love my old car, so I'm going to miss it. But hopefully this thing will hold up. And I've got enough warranty to last me for quite a while. So at least the next 5 years, I should be good. So we'll see how it goes. Anyway, enough about me. So I was actually wanted to get in touch with you again just about the newest back and forth about the autonomous driving thing. And I did notice that there was a news story about how the Trump administration is kind of relaxing the rules on whether on car manufacturers having to log safety reports for their driverless vehicles. So I guess it's more of a suggestion now that they do this instead of a requirement. And so they've kind of relaxed the rules around doing that. And so the article seemed to signal anyway that this was quite a significant development, that the relaxation of these rules would make it much easier for manufacturers to move their programs ahead without having these consistent and constant check-ins with the federal government. So at least from that aspect, you know, it seems like there's a little bit of a clearing in the clouds for manufacturers to move their programs ahead a little bit more quickly. And I know there's also been some talk of the accident, the Tesla accident, that you've talked about several times, where the driver was decapitated when he basically his car went under a tractor trailer. And they did end up ruling that the Tesla system did have some responsibility there. But, you know, the implication was that the guy was not using it correctly. And I think you mentioned that he was watching something on Netflix or whatever, but they did say that there was, that the system did kind of fail, that I don't know how the system would have put on the brakes or whatever. I mean, if somebody drives in front of you, somebody's going to drive in front of you. So your cruise control can only adapt to so much. So I'm not really sure what could have been done there, but the article seemed to imply that there was some responsibility on the part of Tesla in the official report.
Okay, let me go ahead and interrupt. Now, from what I understand about what the government said, they said that the system was kind of really wasn't responsible for the accident, but it was somehow it was involved in the accident, which was, you know, that's kind of ambiguous. You know, and then they also said that the system was working as it was designed to do. So, and then the other thing that, you know, that's worth throwing in there is what Tesla has said is that that is what prompt that that accident is what prompted them to basically split the sheets. What was the name of that company? It's right on the tip of my tongue, with the Mobileye. Sort of split the sheets with Mobileye because that was the hardware 1.0, the self-driving system, and that all, I guess, all relied on cameras. And they, you know, all Tesla wanted to put radar in there, and I don't know if there's a there, you know, if Mobileye didn't want the radar or what the deal was, but that caused them to, you know, there's some kind of a rift that happened between Tesla and Mobileye. And so then Tesla came up with, oh, we're going to have hardware 2.0 or whatever, and now they're talking about hardware 2.5 or whatever. So and from what I understand, this new hardware that Tesla's all developing in house is not as good as the Mobileye system was, you know, that's in the that the, you know, that they were originally using. But here's the problem. Here's the problem as I see it. When you have a system that sort of is partially, quote-unquote, autonomous, it's doing things for you, then what do you do as a human being? You have a tendency to just kind of let it do its job. And so, you know, when you have something, you know, you're supposed to be paying attention, but the thing's steering for you, and it's, you know, and back then, of course, they weren't, I don't even know if they were requiring them to put their hands on the steering wheel. So I'd have to go back and, you know, kind of research that, but they may not have even been doing that. But the thing's steering for you, and it's, you know, it's kind of watching, you think it's watching the road ahead for you. Of course, it was using the camera system, and the camera system couldn't distinguish a white trailer from the sky, basically, is what happened. So the camera just wasn't, the system just wasn't able to realize or recognize that, you know, there was a tractor trailer that had pulled across the highway. And of course the guy had the thing set, I think he had the cruise control set like 76 miles an hour or something like that, which was a number of miles an hour over the speed limit. And he, for whatever reason, you know, the course of the, there was stories that he was watching a Harry Potter DVD or whatever, you know, and then there were conflicting stories saying no, oh no, he wasn't. Well, regardless, He was obviously distracted because if a truck pulls out in front of you, you're driving along and the truck pull, you know, and you're, especially if you're steering the car, you know, and the truck pulls out in front of you, chances are if you're steering the car, you're going to see that something pulled out in front of you. You know, and your eyes are good enough cameras, you know, you're going to be able to recognize, eye-brain combination is going to be able to recognize, hey, that's not the sky in front of me, that's a truck that just pulled out across the road. I'd, you know, slam on the brakes. So obviously the guy was distracted, or he, you know, was doing something, he wasn't paying attention. And the mechanical system didn't recognize that all of a sudden there was an obstacle in front of the car. So the system was working like it was designed, but the problem is, and I think this is going to be a continuing problem in the future, because these systems are never going to be 100%, you know, I just don't ever see that happening, where they're going to be able to, you know, because there's all these variables that can happen in the real world. And, you know, I don't, you know, you can program a closed system, you know, have some sort of a closed system. Like I saw today, earlier today, I saw there's this article that I read, and, it was about this mechanical dentistry, and it was in China. And so that, you know, they were the dentists were there and they had a picture of it. And the dentists were there and they were all suited up, you know, with their surgical masks and what have you. But this robot, they'd programmed this robot to be able to, it was just kind of an arm thing, to be able to do dental implant surgery. And it did, apparently, according to the article, which you never can believe what you read in articles because they never get it right. If you know something about whatever it is, they almost never get whatever it is right. But according to the article, this arm, this robot arm system, was able to do all of the drilling and the bone implant stuff that was involved in this woman's dental implant surgery. And I don't know, they didn't really say if they did several at once or just one, probably just one, I'm assuming. I don't know, but they didn't say that, of course. But this, you know, it was able to, supposedly this robot arm was able to do this dental surgery, this implant surgery, all by itself, under the supervision of the regular dentists. Now, in that case, that's a kind of a closed system. What variables are there in your mouth? You know, and they did say that the thing was programmed to, it could recognize individual variation in people's bone structure, et cetera, and it was able to compensate for that. And I'm sure they, of course they never said, but I'm sure that they had probably had really, you know, maybe they'd done an MRI on the woman's jaw or whatever, so that the thing knew exactly where the bone was, and it was, everything was precise. Because it did say that it was able to also respond to the patient's movements. It did make that point. So everything's precise, and so there's nothing that can, you know, everything's known. There's no variables. So in that case, you can program something to do that, and it's gonna work well. That great, awesome. But you get out on a highway with vehicles, you know, and other vehicles, animals running across the road, wheels coming off of vehicles, wheels, you know, tires exploding, debris on the roadway. There's just so many variables that that can't be accounted for ahead of time. So you have this automated system that, you know, that can do a lot of things, and human beings just don't respond well when you have an automated system that's not 100%. You know, in the real world, that's probably, I wouldn't even know that if it was 50%. Because if you had a closed system, let's say you had a closed roadway and you knew that, and you know, everything was fenced off, there was no debris on the road, no possibility of animals or anything running across or other vehicles cutting in front, then you can have a system like that that's able, in the thing, lines are painted properly on the road. Then you can have a system where the thing can keep its lane and you could, you know, sit back in the back seat and go to sleep or whatever, and it would probably be safe because it's a closed system. But it, you know, out in the real world, can't do that. So is it, would that even be 50%? Probably not. 50% safe? Probably not. But yet, when you put a human being in front of something, you know, in a system like that, then it's easy to begin to think, oh, well, this thing is really good. It's gonna respond properly in every situation. I can just let my attention go. And that's obviously what the guy did. So that's the danger of these systems, you know. So, you know, they can work really well if you can get rid of all the variables. If you can really know what the, you know, in the case of scanning the woman's mouth and her bone and what have you, then you know all of the, you know, all of the potential things. Excuse me. Then you can program it and it can work fine, no problem. And even compensate for the patient's movement, being, you know, kind of moving to a certain extent. But when it comes right down to the other, you know, if you don't know what all the variables are, and you can't know what all the variables are in the real world, you know, surface of the earth, even if it's a highway, you can't know all the variables, then it's, you know, there's going to be situations that happen that just cannot be accounted for. So in any case, Tesla, you know, they're supposedly, now they've added radar beside the cameras. They've added radar and, you know, they're still working on the system, and I don't, you know, I think I read this one article that it kind of implied that, you know, Elon Musk has probably oversold this because people went ahead and, you know, right now they're buying the thing. Oh, it's going to be full autonomy. We just haven't turned it on yet. We have it, but it's just not good. You know, we haven't turned it on yet, but we have it and it works, he said. You know, in an attempt to put pressure on the software team. And of course, this software team, you know, people are quitting that. You know, they've had a super high turnover rate with it. And there was a guy that had been at Apple for years, and he came in and he was, you know, they were all talking, all these Apple podcasts I listened to, they were talking about how wonderful it was. This guy was really going to be able to, you know, put that autonomy software in shape, Tesla's autonomy thing, that program. And he had resigned within 6 months. So I am skeptical when it comes to the idea that you're going to have all this autonomy, you know, super cruise control, you know, maybe. Steering, I don't know that, you know, you can do steering assistance, but if you try to have the vehicle steer itself, that's, you know, and still have a human being that's there sitting behind the wheel that's supposed to be paying attention, that's a pretty hard thing to do. You know, can you, would you be able to sit for hours in front of something and just watch it and make sure that it was doing its job as a human being with, you know, with nothing else to do, you know, no other distractions, you're just supposed to sit there and watch it. Make sure it does its job, ready to take over at a moment's notice. Think you could handle that? Probably not. I don't think I could. My attention would end up being distracted. So that's why I tell people, you know, the biggest thing is, if you want to be safe as a driver, one of the biggest things you can do is stay back away from the other vehicles. If you got a vehicles in front of you, stay back away from them, because you will, I don't care what, how good of a driver you are or how good you think you are, you will become distracted. And so if, you know, if you got, if you're right on top of another vehicle and something happens, then if you're, you know, when the time comes and you're, you know, and it will happen that you're going to be distracted at some point, you don't have, you won't have time to react. But if you, something does happen, the traffic ahead of you slamming on the brakes or whatever, and you're distracted for a, you know, even just for a split second, then you, you know, if you've left enough room, even though you were distracted, you still have time to recover. So that's the biggest thing that I, the biggest mistake I see people making driving, whether it's trucks or cars or whatever, is they're too close to the vehicles in front. That includes motorcycles. They're too close to the vehicles in front of them. So, anyhow, let's go on with Jeremy's comment.
Now, I didn't see anything as far as will there be any implications or any reparations having to be paid to the family or whatever, but it's possible, I suppose, that if that's not part of this, that that would develop into some kind of lawsuit. I'm sure there's already a lawsuit, but I think that there may have been some findings that at least partially supported the plaintiff's case that Tesla was somewhat liable for this, and maybe there was something there where maybe originally they wanted a pile of money and now they're just going to get like a little mound of money. I don't know. But anyway, so those were the two developments that I was wanting to get your thoughts on. And I guess the main thing about the autonomous vehicle program moving forward a little bit more quickly with their, with, you know, other manufacturers, like I know every manufacturer's got their thumb in that pie. But, you know, we're not clear to what extent some of the other ones intend to compete with Tesla, because most likely they're so far behind. But, you know, I'm kind of hoping that it turns out to be that there's some sort of, I almost hate to say like a standard that develops in the industry for, you know, for the batteries, the battery components. But, you know, I still think that the supercharger thing is kind of a misnomer, because that having to wait somewhere for a half an hour, it just doesn't make sense. Like, it's one thing if you're on a road trip and you need to stop and stretch for a few minutes, you know, and go to the bathroom. If you can't get a full charge in 5 minutes, not a full charge even, like a half charge, say a half charge in 5 minutes, that's like something I would say is doable. But the idea that you could just assume that every 300 miles you're going to pull over for a half an hour, that's just craziness. So I just think that's something that they're going to have to really work on in order for this adoption to be you know, even make sense. Like, there's not going to be mass adoption for something where you have to wait so long for your car to be charged. And I think that if there was a standard where, kind of like unleaded fuel or whatever, like there's a certain and I don't want it to be regulated by the government, but I would like, you know, the industry to agree on something where, they can do some sort of a battery swap out. And I think they did try this in England for a company that ended up failing because it only worked with a couple of different cars. But the idea that you could just kind of go in, drive onto a ramp, and then have a machine swap out your battery so that there's always a fresh battery kind of sitting there waiting. And it's more of a battery exchange program. So if all the batteries are haven't been charged, they're, you know, sort of on a conveyor, but if there's none of them currently available, then you would just have the red light on that station. You wouldn't be able to use it. But that the hope is that, you know, you would have some way of driving up, locking in your wheels, and then having a machine access, you know, the underside of your vehicle and remove a safety panel and swap out a battery for a fully charged one. And so the battery becomes more a part of the energy ecosystem as opposed to being a part of your chassis, and that the batteries are interchangeable with one another. And I think that that would make more sense too for, like, say, a vehicle warranty, so that you don't have to consider that the battery is part of your expense. It's more a part of, like, you know, maybe you can have a separate company that deals with the energy part of it, where they're saying, yeah, you can for a contract price, you can use our battery charging or changing stations. And that gives you free access to our infrastructure of battery exchange depots. And that would mean that is completely separate from a consideration of a company like a Tesla, even though I know Tesla probably wants to be the one in that marketplace, if that marketplace ever developed, because they're the super gigafactory battery guys. But ultimately, I think that that's probably going to be what would cause, like, mass adoption, because then you could buy the chassis, the vehicle, separate from the battery. And I think that that would kind of make it a viable option for more people, where if they want out of one, they don't have to worry. The battery service would just kind of follow them to their next car. Maybe that's not very practical with the way that technology progresses. That it's not it's a bad thing to lock yourself into the infrastructure that, you know, that infrastructure would have to be adaptable to different car types and batteries, battery sizes and things like that. But if there's at least like a, you know, like batteries today, we have standard for batteries that go into devices. So if you have, maybe not phone batteries, but, you know, like a AA batteries, AAA batteries, and maybe that's an oversimplification for lithium ion as a technology, or whatever new hydrogen powered batteries or whatever that might come out. You know, I know that the shape and the form factor is going to have to change as technology improves. But if these stations can be updated to accommodate those new battery standards, or those new battery types that are developed conform to a standard, so that maybe, you know, the height might change because, you know, battery wafers might get thinner and thinner over time, or you might be able to stack multiple batteries inside of a chassis inside of the same space, where like a AAA battery might fit in the same place as like one 9-volt battery, or multiple AAA batteries could fit in the same cavity as one 9-volt. But today that wouldn't work, you know, with those device batteries. But I'm just saying there's a possibility that we could come up with some sort of a standard where maybe the width and the depth are the same. And then the only thing that changes based on the car type is the height of it or something like that, you know, or how many cells that you have, depending on the range you want or need for that time. And then if you wanted to swap out one battery, you know, you might pay one price. And if you want to swap out all three batteries because you want to go further before you have to stop at another charging station, then you get three batteries. I don't know. So this all is just pure speculation. It might be completely impractical. But my thought is just that there's going to have to be some kind of system like that. And I suspect that maybe before we even get to that point, that there's going to be a whole other type of energy source that gets applied to these vehicles. And that just, you know, the battery technology itself would take a generational leap. And this won't even be a problem anymore, where, you know, we're just kind of things charge very quickly. You know, that'll be the next kind of breakthrough. And hopefully we're getting there soon. But anyway, so that's it. I just wanted to check in. Get your sense for where we're at with that, and then also the battery form factor. I don't know if I brought this up before or not, but it's something I've thought about for a while. And it just seems like there's no way you could make it so that, for example, like a truck, if you're going to have like a truck, an electric truck, it's going to require a lot more power. So you would need some kind of a form factor where you could use the same batteries, but maybe just a bigger stack of them. And then you could, you know, go a lot further with it and pull a lot more weight. I'm also just, you know, I think like things like electric, I don't know, like electric trains and stuff like that. Like, it just seems like there's a point where, you know, there has to be some sort of a standard where all these companies like your GEs and your Chevrolets and all these you know, your Toyota, your foreign manufacturers, like they're all going to be off in their own little world, creating their own stuff. But somehow we did come to a point where we agreed on the different types of battery cells for smaller devices. So we just kind of need to take that same approach to electric vehicles and we'll get somewhere. I've also been seeing lately a lot of buzz about the flying cars. And I was curious, you know, along those same lines, I think there's a new one is kind of like electric jet powered flying car. I forget the name of the manufacturer, but I know it's a well-known name. It has the backing of a lot of high-profile Silicon Valley investors, and they actually had a successful test flight about a year ago, and they just, I think, got a $90 million round of funding that they closed, and they are kind of, you know, the buzz is they're looking to be the one. There's been a few of these along the way, but none with like the $90 million funding, that they're the ones that kind of want to make it mainstream. And of course, we all know by mainstream, that means, you know, like in a city like New York City, you might have a few really rich people that have flying cars. And that's how everything mainstream begins. Just like the rich people with the car phones back in the day, you know, it's the same idea that it's going to take being able to see them in practical use with the poor people that can afford them. And they're going to be completely unaffordable for normal people for a long time. But then the form factor will just get smaller and smaller or more reproducible or whatever. But that was the other thing that I had seen with the flying cars. With the newest one that I saw was that it was kind of an electric thing, which really does take away some of what are the downsides of what I've seen with the vertical takeoff and landing vehicles anyway. It's just the noise is immense. Those engines are, you know, if you have jet engines, it already makes enough noise just with the airspeed alone. But if you have like if they're combustion powered turbines, that's just crazy. So it's just crazy loud. And it seemed like with the electric motors, they were going to be able to quiet them down quite a bit, and really for a viable flying car, you know, to work in a city, you would have to have one that did not require an airstrip. And I think that was the whole thing with this, was that it was also a vertical takeoff and landing form factor. So it got around all of the, you know, I've seen the clips of the cars that fold into airplanes after they land and you can drive to your garage or whatever. But those all require a basic, you know, pilot's license, and they all kind of require you to have, to be able to take off and land on a runway. So they need, you know, a good, you know, quarter mile, half mile, whatever, to take off on. So it basically requires you to have an airfield. And, you know, that's another thing that would prevent mass adoption of a flying car to begin with. You know, if you're going to have a flying car get adopted by rich people, you're going to need to have it be able to land on a helipad somewhere and, you know, drive over to a parking space. And that's the whole point of this, is that it's going to be one of those things where you could vertically take off and land. And that really widens the playing field for adoption, for mass adoption. So anyway, and it also didn't seem like it was going to be terribly expensive. Like, it's not going to be the price of like a private jet or anything like that. We're talking about, you know, $100,000, not, you know, multiple billions of dollars or millions of dollars. I mean, not billions, obviously. But yeah, so it seemed like it was going to be somewhat affordable. There are videos of this thing, of at least its first flight, which seemed pretty impressive. And got me to thinking the other day, because I was listening to another podcast. I know this is going long, so I'll try to speed this up a little bit. But I was listening to one of these. I like to listen to a lot of paranormal podcasts and stuff. There's a new one that was out. It was somebody telling just scary stories about, you know, flying owl men that were being sighted in the Chicago area. So this is like, I guess, a relatively new phenomenon where it's like almost like, you know, if you've heard of the Mothman or whatever, it's like, you know, guys, like men with wings basically flying around. And somebody had reported a sighting in Chicago where they saw somebody like a humanoid with wings, like swoop over them and then go up the side of a building and just kind of hover there alongside the building before it flew away. And it got me to thinking, the way drones are working today, and drones can see, they seem like drones can pull quite a bit of weight. And I started thinking about the old jetpacks and how when you see those being used, they're pretty clumsy. And I've seen some of the hoverboard clips where the guy's got basically a hoverboard that he can fly for miles in now, you know, and that's the thing where it flies, you know, 12, 15 feet off the ground. And that's all, you know, again, it's all fans. So very loud, very impractical. But I think, like, what if you had something that could strap onto your back and it was just basically drone props on four corners that extended away from your body to the point where it wasn't dangerous, where it wouldn't necessarily get in your way. And the props were on rotating arms. So they could rotate, for example, if they could rotate both in and out, but also rotate up and down, so that if you had it strapped to your back, what would prevent you from being able to use it like a jetpack? And it seems to me that that's something that could explain some of these sightings, especially the kind where the people are flying through the air and then flying kind of up to a side of a building and just kind of hovering there, looking outside a window. Like, what would prevent you from being able to do that? I couldn't think of any reason why you wouldn't be able to make some sort of a drone structured apparatus, I guess is the word I was looking for, that would strap around your body and extend, if the props extended away from your body enough that it wouldn't, you know, tangle up your limbs or whatever. I see no reason why it would just depend on the size of the rotors and the strength of the motors, and it couldn't at least lift a small person off the ground. And that would explain the ability to do that. It seems to me like that would be a good solution for, you know, replacing the old traditional jetpack that we've seen for so long. And I don't know why it wouldn't be possible to do this. So anyway, all right, now I'm just rambling. I'll leave you with that, Tom. Hope you're safe out there. Hope everything's going well. Talk to you soon, I hope.
Okay, well, thank you, Jeremy. Now, regarding the batteries, you know, the battery thing is kind of a problem. Now, I watch tons of Tesla videos, you know, where the people, they've got their car, and of course, they're just all psyched up about how, you know, how wonderful the car is, and, you know, and so you see the typical video, what they do, they will show, you know, here we are traveling, you know, and they may speed the video up or whatever, you know, of the thing, you know, typically they'll show the scenery, you know, the landscape going by, or maybe they've got a dash cam, you know, kind of aimed at the road or whatever. And then they, you know, and they'll show a little bit of that, and then they, oh, we're here at such and such supercharger, and we're going to get so much of a charge, and so we're going to walk over to whatever, and we're going to eat, or whatever it is that's around the supercharger. And then they get finished with that one, and then, you know, they show some more scenery going by, and then they're at the next supercharger or whatever. And, you know, it's almost like their enthusiasm for the car, you know, for the Teslas, is so high that they're sort of willing to put up with all of the waiting. You know, all of these charge, they have to go to these superchargers and they have to wait. And that seems to be, you know, they're sort of compensating, or, you know, or in their own minds, they're sort of justifying the waiting. Now, if you're on a trip somewhere, that may be all well and good, and you may be happy with whatever compromise you've made, and, you know, and people do that with vehicles in general. You know, whatever vehicle you have at home, you know, you'll sort of justify, if you like the vehicle, then you're going to just kind of put up with whatever its quirks are. And you're willing to live with it, I guess. But, you know, that's one segment of the market. And, of course, these people are paying a lot for their vehicles. So the more you pay for something, generally speaking, the more you pay for something, the more expensive it is, the higher the value you're going to put on it. You know, if someone just gives you something, that's typically, you don't put very much value on it. If something's just handed to you, you don't put very much, psychologically, you don't put very much value on it. So, you know, Pete, their, you know, $100,000 vehicle or more, or, you know, most of these people that have the Teslas, that, you know, they've paid anywhere from $75,000 to $100,000, $120,000, $150,000 in some cases, with the model, you know, like the really super duper Model X or whatever, on the top end. And of course, they're gonna, you know, psychologically, they're going to say, yes, this is just wonderful. It, you know, my car will go, you know, I can charge and it'll go 300 miles with the P100D or whatever. Well, you know, I hate to be the bearer of, you know, break up the party, but my, you know, this little Toyota Yaris that I bought 6 months, you know, coming up on, I guess about 6 months ago, it was back in May. This is September, you know, September already. You know, $17,000, $18,000 car. And my range, if I fill it up, it only, you know, it holds like maybe 10 gallons or something. 10 gallons and something. 10 gallons and change, whatever. My range is, if I fill it up, typically the range is, let's say, 420 miles or so. And I'm getting a pretty reliable 41 miles per gallon. You know, and so do I have range anxiety? Absolutely not. How often do I have to put gas in it? Not very often. Depends on how much I drive. And when I do put gas in it, it usually doesn't take a whole lot, obviously. So, but the battery thing, you know, it's going to improve. It, you know, the batteries are kind of slowly getting better. You know, people are coming up with new battery chemical formulations are coming up with new formulations, and I have no doubt that if the popularity of electric vehicles continues, if that actually kind of organically continues, then it's going to demand, you know, people will find, where there's a will, there's a way. People will find solutions to the battery problems. And, it kind of may not be what we think it is. You know, it's sort of like, you know, trucking. There's a lot of people that have an idea, you know, what trucking should be. and how it should work. You know, and this even includes people that work, you know, let's say they work in the trucking industry, you know, and they're the dispatchers or whatever, or load planners. And certainly the shippers and the receivers, they have an idea of how it should work to varying degrees. And to varying degrees, they're way off the mark with the actual reality of it. And so there's a lot of people that, you know, by the same token, they think that, you know, this is how the transportation business should work. But it, you know, in the real world, it doesn't work exactly the way we think that it should. To varying degrees. So, you know, the idea we're going to have battery-operated trucks, well, that's possible. I think it's possible that there could be some battery-operated trucks in certain situations, especially maybe, you know, that are going, that don't go very far, that are in cities or whatever. But the type of trucking I do, typically, I may have 40,000 pounds, 45,000 pounds of cargo. And a 53-foot trailer that may or may not have to be refrigerated, which that's a whole nother thing, you know, because you have to have energy for, you have to have some energy supply for that, keeping it refrigerated, or maybe, you know, minus 10, minus 20, depending on what it is. If it's like a load of ice cream, it has to be kept at minus 20. I like the load I have right now is a load of, you know, it's candy and it's like 55 degrees, so the reefer unit comes on and off ever so often. So, you know, how, you know, you're going to have batteries that, let's say you have to be able to go, you know, 700 to 1,000 miles in a truck without having to stop and recharge. You know, how long is the recharge going to take? And then what about the weight of the batteries? You know, is the weight of the batteries going to begin to eat into the cargo capacity, weight-wise? So there's a lot of unanswered questions. And then the other problem is, well, it's going to be, you know, maybe you can have a battery-operated truck or electric truck that it's going to be really a lot cheaper than diesel fuel, for example. But is that battery-operated truck going to be able to, it won't be able to haul as much because you have a weight limit of 80,000 pounds. So it's not going to be able to haul as much cargo, and then it's not going to be able to go as far, and then maybe, you know, before it has to be recharged, or then you try to come up with the idea, well, we're going to have replaceable batteries. Where are you going to put those batteries? Are you going to, you know, is every trailer going to have to be replaced with, you know, because then they think, oh, well, we'll put batteries in the trailer. Well, what, you know, you can't, because you've got different kinds of trailers. You've got, you know, and it's a universal system, basically. So that any truck can pull any trailer. You know, I'm talking, you know, like vans, flatbeds. Pretty much, you know, it's a universal system. So one truck is able to hook on to most any trailer. It's, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, where are you going to put those batteries? You're going to have to replace all the trailers. And then what about the cargo? Is the truck itself going to be able to hold enough batteries? Where would you put those batteries? Like at the truck that I have right here, where would I put all those batteries at? Because they obviously take up a whole lot more room than the fuel tanks do. And the current truck that I have right now would easily be able to drive 700 miles without having to be refilled with fuel. And yet, overall, the volume of the fuel isn't that big compared to the size of the truck. just, and I'm talking about just the tractor itself. So there's a lot of problems with that, you know, and then you get into the problem of like rocket motors. Because a rocket motor, and I've talked about this before, you know, you have a, you know, the more, you know, if you want to add more rocket fuel, then it adds more weight to the rocket, and therefore you have to have more fuel to lift that, you know, to you know, get it to escape velocity. So then it becomes a real problem. You know, how are you going to, you know, you know, if you're going to have interplanetary travel, where are you going to get your fuel at? You know, are you going to be able to have enough fuel to complete the trip to wherever it is, let's say to Mars? How are you going to do that? You know, so you get into kind of the diminishing returns problem. So there has to be an incentive, and it can't be the stick kind of incentive. You know, there's been a lot of European governments here lately that have said, you know, the Chinese as well, they've said, well, we're going to ban the sale of new internal combustion engine vehicles and, you know, such and such date. And that's it. We're just going to cut it off and everything's going to have to be electric. I don't see that actually working very well. But if you make the things, you know, and Elon Musk has kind of done it, you know, make the thing really desirable, make it a desirable vehicle, aspirational, then, you know, and make the thing work right, well, then you now you're talking. But it's still horrifically expensive. You know, with this Model 3, you've got the promise of a $35,000 car, which is still, you know, in my book, that's kind of an expensive vehicle. I'm sorry. But a $35,000 vehicle is kind of pricey, and yet that's the base. And they're not, you know, and so the vehicle that most people really want is probably going to be upwards of $60,000. So, it's still, you know, even that Model 3 is still pretty expensive. And it's just not practical. I'm sorry, but it's not a practical thing for the vast majority of people. Now, you know, depending on what your, you know, what your income is and what you're willing to spend on it. So it's an ongoing problem. And then you have the other problem with the Tesla, you know, and they don't like to talk about it. Elon Musk certainly doesn't like to talk about it, but you know, you have all the so-called incentives and the government, you know, the tax rebates that sort of, that's, you know, this designed to, you know, spur these people into buying. Oh, well, I can get the however much $7,500 tax rebate or whatever. Well, that's a subsidy, you know, so the government's subsidizing it. You know, some of the state governments also subsidize it. What happens if you take those subsidies away? Is it so desirable then? Probably not. And you're subsidizing, you're giving this subsidy to people that, you know, can really afford to not have the subsidy. You know, you take a $50,000 or $100,000 car or more, and then they get their subsidy on top of it. Well, if they can afford that kind of a car, then they can probably afford to not have the subsidy. So you're sort of subsidizing... sort of, you know, you can say, well, you're sort of subsidizing the rich. So, I don't know. It's, you know, if the model, this Model 3, you know, if they really sell a lot of those, and then at some point the subsidy, you know, is supposed to go away, then we'll see what, you know, in the next, maybe in the next few years, we'll see if there really is a market for it or not. Now, you know, and then of course you have the chicken and egg problem. Once you get enough production going, that lowers the price of whatever it is. Then the price can really start to go down. Once it becomes a mass-produced item, then, and that's true with everything. If you can get the, you know, make it a mass-produced item, mass production, then the cost per unit, individual unit, goes down. And, you know, and then at some point it might become, it might be such a thing that it becomes affordable. But right now I would say probably, unless you've got money to burn, I would say stay away from it, because it's still sort of a, you know, it's still a bleeding edge thing, really super cutting edge, bleeding edge. And I would, you know, you're better off staying away from it, because any kind of bleeding edge thing, and I've done my share of, you know, buying into bleeding edge electronic stuff over the years. And nowadays I tend to just shy away from it and just wait until it stabilizes. And I think the electric vehicle thing is far from stabilizing. And same way with the autonomous vehicles, you know, and the regular, you know, there's articles that you can go out and find. The regular car companies have been experimenting with autonomous vehicles for a long time. It's not, you know, it may seem like, you know, because Elon Musk is so good at PR, it may seem like Tesla's just, oh, they're light years ahead of everyone else. Well, not necessarily. They've been really bold about deploying the stuff, but they're not really, you know, other car companies have been working on this for quite a few years. So, you know, and it's, and I, as I say, I remain pretty skeptical about if they're going to really be able to make it work in all situations. You know, the way they, you know, the way Elon Musk talks, you know, it's just going to get so good that, you know, it's just going to become ubiquitous. And I'm still pretty skeptical about that. Sorry. I hate to throw cold water on it, but we actually live in the real world. We don't live in a kind of a dream world, how we think the world should work. You know, there's how, you know, what we think should be, and how it really is, how it really functions. You know, and then the flying car thing, you know, I'm kind of skeptical about that as well. You know, now the idea that, you know, you're going to have an electric, you're going to get in this electric thing and it's going to fly for 20 minutes or 30 minutes and take you from wherever to wherever. Sounds great. You know, maybe they, you know, of course they've, you know, they've come up with some prototypes like you were saying, and there's videos of it and what have you. But it's obviously, I mean, that's one thing to make, you know, to be able to make a prototype and kind of demonstrate it in a video. But it's an entirely different thing to bring it to market. You know, and I think what it's going to have to start out as is some sort of a commercial service, where you can, you know, you can call your flying car, you know, or electric thing, whatever, sort of drone, passenger drone type thing, and it's going to have to be some sort of a service, and of course it's going to necessarily be expensive, because that's just the way, that's just the nature of this stuff. And it's going to be expensive, and it's going to be clunky, and if it's something that's really practical, because it has to be practical, then sooner or later, then it, you know, there's a possibility then it could catch on. But I know, you know, a lot of people think that, oh, because they see it in movies, you know, you know, one of the Star Wars movies, they kept showing the high rise, all these high rise buildings, you know, in some city somewhere, you know, with all of the flying vehicles, flying past the high-rise buildings like there is some sort of freeway in the sky, busy freeway in the sky, you know, that's fantasy. It really is a fantasy, or, you know, the Back to the Future thing, you know, in one of those movies, you know, the flying cars. Fantasy. So that's one of those things that I'm pretty skeptical about. So I just don't see that happening. And I know people want to believe, they want to believe that it can happen. Well, you know, sorry, but just because you want something to happen doesn't necessarily mean that it will. So, but I don't know. I've always, you know, you look at what goes on in science fiction, you know, and I've long been a fan of science fiction. But you look at what happens in science fiction, and science fact is never the same as science fiction. You know, I know people say, well, you know, the. Look at Star Trek. They had they had their little tablet computers, and you know, and they can't kind of show the, even in the original Star Trek series, they sort of showed the idea of video conferencing and what have you. Well, sure, it was an idea, but it was actually possible well before it was demonstrated in the original Star Trek series. As soon as, you know, it could have happened in the 1940s. You know, because we had, you know, they had televisions and TV cameras and what, that could have been possible then, but the market really didn't exist for it. So a lot of this stuff, if the market is ready for something, then it can possibly be developed, but you know, a lot of people they want to make their science fiction come true, and it's not going to happen. And if it does, it's not going to be what they think it is, or what they thought it would be. So, overall, I would say, you know, hold off on the electric car stuff. I would wait until it's going to have to really be mainstream before it becomes practical. Unless you want to pay through the nose for it, be on the bleeding edge, I would stay away from it. You know, and the flying car thing, really skeptical about that. Don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. So, anyway, probably better be cutting this off. Hope everyone is having a great weekend. It is the weekend. And I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.